And I will plumb in Jeweled for sure at the opening of this, because it's such a great piece of music. It'll have to be short because copyright, but it's just the best piece of music. It is the only piece of music. Actually, that's a lie. It is a piece of music that instantly brings to mind like escorts sliding in forests, and it's so evocative for people of a certain age who watched BBC Top Gear Rally Report.
Or Top Gear, Tony Mason standing in a... Was it somewhere Scandinavian where he got a snowball to the side of his face on camera?
The famous snowball, yes. But it's just that, it just feels like you should just have cars on the lock stop sliding in and out of frame. Yeah. And they should be, you know, the RS Cosworths and Sierras and stuff.
Yeah, Escorts and Legacies and 6R4s.
No, I'd be later than that. 6R4s, you're looking at late 80s, early 90s. So you're right, Legacies. And, I don't know, Nissan Sunnies and stuff.
Anyway, let's crack on. So, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Auto Movie Podcast Rallying Special. We're very loosely tying together the things that we're going to talk about today with rallying. Just for authenticity, Marty Spain is with me as ever, and he is currently standing in Kielder Forest waiting for some cars to come past. And I'm in the Arctic. There will be a rally through here at some point that we'll get to later. But first, shall we remove our bobble hats and talk about the Grand Tour, as if we haven't done that enough recently.
I don't want to remove my bobble hat. I'm a rally fan. Actually, you know what? I don't own a bobble hat. I own a hat, but I don't own a bobble hat. So maybe I'm not a proper rally fan. I need to go and sort that out.
What about like one of those puffy bomber jackets with like Talbot written across the back or something?
No, I don't have that. You know my feelings on like merch and stuff like that, on like team wear. My feelings on team wear are very strong. That if you are not part of the team, you should not wear team wear. Team wear replicas, bad.
That's true. Unless it's given
to you. If you're given
you.
It, yes, unless it's given to you. Like for years, I had a BMW Salva F1 polo shirt that I got from, I think it was when we went to Germany to watch Nick Heidfeld go round the Nordschleife in his BMW Salva. And I had a pen as well, a BMW Salva pen. They were given to me, and I'm like, okay, oh, these are cool. And it was a cool polo shirt. But if you go and buy like a replica Lewis Hamilton shirt or something, you know, the slightly overly tight white shirts that the team all wear on F1, that's just not for me. Anyway, digressed, which is what we do. But yes, talk to me about Amazon seeking pitches for Grand Tour.
So this was kind of interesting, and I'm not sure it's been picked up too widely in the greater media. This is from the website Television Business International, which, of course, we both...
That's a catchy title. I visit it every day.
Tenterhooks every morning. So the Grand Tour, as it exists, has been produced by a company called Expectation, I think, for the last two series.
Oh, it's not Illumination!
Illumination! It's what, who has kids? This was obviously the brilliantly named W. Chump and Sons was the banner under which May, Hammond, Clarkson and Andy Willman, of course, were doing the show. And we thought, and I think we spoke in the last episode, that the drive had really gone out of the series, to use a slightly awkward metaphor. It was really just the Grand Tour coming to the end of what was really like a sort of 25, 30-year journey, in effect. And now I feel really old. However, it's been, I wouldn't say announced, it's been published by Television Business International that Amazon are seeking pitches for a reworked format from the UK companies All3Media, Shine, and Orchard Studios. The last one that I'm not too familiar with, Shine and All3Media. It's one of those things that you will see at the end of actually a surprising number of shows if you look for them. They're both big production companies here in the UK. There's no details yet for exactly what the new format would be. TBI do helpfully add that All Three Media's Studio Lambert, who have produced things like The Circle, Gogglebox, and the UK versions of The Traitors, while Shine TV is known for MasterChef, Hunted, and The Island with Bear Grylls. I say all of these things without comment.
Oh, God. This does not sound good, right? None of those shows fills me with anticipation or the expectation that they will be able to take this format and do something good with it.
So this is the thing. I don't think they are actually looking for somebody to take up the Grand Tour mantle. I keep wanting to say Drive Tribe. The two are so linked to my head now. The Grand Tour mantle, because they have to know that it is in some way unrepeatable. And I think Wood, Hammond, Clarkson, May, Andy Woolman want to come back when they said they're kind of tired of it. Not really. Which says to me, one, that Amazon owns the Grand Tour brand, and two, they want to do something with it. Now, I think there is going to be a problem here, that if they are going to traditional TV production companies and saying, give us a car-based idea, we both know that those tend not to work brilliantly. However, we now have this whole ocean of original content on YouTube made by car enthusiasts who know what they're talking about, who are passionate about the subject, and have said that they don't really kind of want to go into the Top Gear world because they like the control and all of these sorts of things. It's notable that Mr. Beast, Jimmy Donaldson, is now doing a show with Amazon in the US for a, what do they called it? Something very specific. The biggest single prize in TV history. So basically some contestant on this Amazon show is going to win $5 million because that's a very Mr. Beast thing to do. But are Amazon going to find something? Bearing in mind that Amazon not only do they, obviously people sign up to Amazon Prime for the TV, but they also talk about things like the Grand Tour were paid for by Amazon because they want to attract new users to the platform. And would you sign up if somebody goes, there's a new Grand Tour with Jeff, Steve and Rob, and they're going to go and do crazy things?
They're going to have to work very hard on a good idea. I could see this potentially getting to the pitch stage and two or three of these production companies actually putting together a pilot episode.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see them like either just going, no, this sucks. No, you're trying to do what the original trio did, but worse.
Mm.
This is going to take some time. Every day's Christmas Eve. Let's assume that it's going to be good. I'm not thinking about it. Maybe Amazon don't own the Grand Tour. Maybe, I don't know, maybe W Chump and Sons have sold on the rights for that. I don't know. And they don't talk about this kind of thing. But what I think is you either cast or you bring in some unknowns and you do loads of chemistry tests, or you look to existing people who are known to be good on television and like cars. That did not work so well when Top Gear used Chris Evans.
But it has worked repeatedly with Top Gear USA, Top Gear Australia.
It has.
Throttle House.
Oh, man. There are so many people you could put forward to this. It's like you say, whether they want to do it or not.
Yeah.
Either way, I will wait and see what happens. Really, it's the kind of thing where once they sign off with the last Grand Tour special, I will consider the Grand Tour dead until at some point it pops up in my feed. It's interesting. I said it would have been great had they basically had some kind of succession planning going on, but I don't think they planned that far ahead. I just think you could take the Grand Tour brand, which is established to be very much like this one thing, and they could go, and now this is the Grand Tour, and it could suck.
Mm.
And it would then put you off the other stuff. It would kind of very, very slightly tarnish what had come before because they just slapped it on any old crap that has cars in it.
Yeah.
I hope they don't do that. But anyway, let's move on for that. Is there anything else you want to kind of highlight? We haven't really got any other major news to go for at the moment, have we?
We haven't. It's a bit of a quiet news time at the moment. No, I think let's go straight on to our review, which, before we get into it, before I reveal what it is, if you haven't already noticed from the name of this episode, had you heard of this, like, when it came out?
I'm sure we must have covered it at some point, in terms of we're here, there is this thing. I don't remember watching a trailer. I think I remember, like, press releases saying they're going to do this. And I remember distinctly thinking, hang on, Clarkson's already covered this story and done it in as engaging a fashion as I think it could be told. So how on earth are they going to make this more engaging by stretching it out? And if you haven't seen that, it's in the Grand Tour. It is maybe end of series two?
It's something like that, yeah.
I am struggling to remember that. But, there, you know, Jeremy loves to tell these stories of underdog, and therefore it's a wonderful telling of how Lancer battled Audi. And it's done in typical Clarkson fashion, but they do have some restages. And more to the point, because Amazon money and, you know, it's Clarkson, they go and interview all the proper people. They have Valter Roll talking about why he didn't do a full season of rallying that year. He just did the rallies he wanted to do. They have a famous quote where he just says, "I don't like jumps," which I don't blame him in a Lancer that's made out of cheese and string. You don't want to do too many hard landings on that thing because it might bend like a banana. And, yeah. Sorry, no is the short answer.
I'm now laughing at a joke from the Grand Tour when they did their French thing and they're all sitting around the table.
How about instead of making good cars, we make the terrible cars?
Have you seen that been memed up to cover Alpine?
Yes, the Alpine
F1 team is now using that meme, which I find very, very funny because I have... Much though I very much admire the Alpine road cars and find myself wanting an A110 more and more and more, I find the F1 team annoying. And I can't put my finger on quite why, because I don't dislike Esteban Ocon and I quite like Pierre Gasly. But just, no. Call it Renault or give up.
Pretty much.
And it seems like they've more or less decided to call it Alpine and give up. But anyway, we're getting way off topic. That's Formula One. We're doing rallying, yes, which is like sideways and stuff. Right. I'm gonna lean on you because you've seen this more recently than I have.
Yes.
So what did you make of Race for Glory colon space Audi versus Lancer?
So to give you the story of it, so this is, as you say, it's following Audi and Lancia. Are we officially saying Lancia? Is that our proper pronunciation?
Lancia. Oh, Lancia. I don't know. Let's say it whichever way you want. I've always said Lancia, I think, is how you're supposed to say it. But as a kid, when I had a little Stratos thing to push around that lit up when you pushed it, I've always said Lancia.
I've always said Lancia as well. But we'll say Lancia because I think that's the proper way. Anyway, so this is a story that takes place against the backdrop of the 1983 World Rally Championship. We are in the era where Audi has come out with the Quattro. They have moved the game on when it comes to how rally cars would then be made for the rest of time. Lancia, don't have a four-wheel drive system. Instead, they have the Type 037. Is this 037?
003? It's the 037 is what everyone calls it. Yeah.
And this film follows specifically the... And I'm going to apologise here because I'm going to butcher this all the way through. This film follows the Lancia team boss, Cesar Fiorio, who was the driving force behind the team. He is trying to get the best car. He's trying to overcome this technological deficiency. The film opens with him being interviewed, and it's not clear whether it's pre or post season or during the season. And it tries to set up this idea that Audi is this technology force, Lancia have passion and they have drive and they are competitive.
And they have martini stripes. Martini stripes is the thing they should have opened with. Look, our cars look better than yours, right? I don't even know. Like, I have never had anything that's had martini in it, I don't think. And yet, that is just the best. It might be the second best rally livery of all time.
So Martini Rosso, if you ever have a Negroni, Martini Rosso is one of the classic ingredients. If you ever have Martini Blanco, which is the white stuff, it goes quite well in a risotto, and otherwise it tastes manky. I would not recommend it.
No, I don't think I've... Negroni is a thing that I see like flashy people have. I'm too simple to understand all of these things.
It's like medicated cough syrup.
Yeah, okay.
Alcoholic cough syrup. Cough syrup is by definition
medicated.
If
I want to drink that kind of things, I'll have a vodka Red Bull or something.
Oh, fizzy power steering fluid. So it's the story of that season, effectively, but told from the point of view of the Lancia team boss, his struggles, his negotiations in inverted commas with Walter Röhl, the kind of rivalry with Audi and the team boss there, Roland Gumpert, played by Daniel Brühl, who some of you might remember as Niki Lauda in Rush. I'm thinking about videos later on. I'll come back to that.
Yes.
Like I say, it follows him through the season. It follows the ups and downs of Lancia through the season. It's very much a Lancia story. This isn't one of those... It sounds a bit like a documentary. It sounds like it's going to be balanced. It sounds like it's going to be a bit of Lancia, a bit of Audi. Here's ups and downs. No, this is a Lancia story first and foremost. I will say the first thing that gripped me with this, and all the way through, I was so impressed with, and this sounds like damning it with faint praise, which it kind of is, but the production design, the way that they've recreated the 80s rallying scene is extraordinary.
I thought where did you get all that stuff from was what was yes. going through my mind a lot of it, because I don't know. Do people keep all these things? Old team trucks, all the stuff? I was very impressed with that too. I think the other thing that very much impressed me with is the sound design in this is exceptional. Mm. They've clearly gone to town having access to the cars, recording them to get the soundtrack to be as good as possible, as accurate as possible, which is not always a given in automotive films. So I thought that was very good. And again, I feel like I'm damning it with faint praise because I'm sure you, as I have thoughts as to where the rest of the film goes. But continue.
So let's talk about the film. I think there was one thing that did catch my eye, and I messaged you about this earlier today. Right before the end credits, there is a very, very big, very clear disclaimer that says this film is based on events. This film takes some of the characters and situations and may create other ones for narrative and dramatic effect. It's basically saying
we made a bunch of shit up.
We made stuff
we made
up
a load of
to
it
make
up.
The story work. To which I say...
Which is useless.
Well, it's not. But why didn't you make up a better story? Because I think what they tried to make was Ferrari. And if you watch Ferrari, there is, throughout Enzo's life, or throughout the period portrayed in the film, you see the dark, you see the light, you see the mistress, you see the strife, you see the struggles with his wife, the fact that he's this kind of respected figure in one context and he's downtrodden in other areas of his life.
Can I interrupt and say what else you see? You see Kenny getting killed. I cannot, for as much as I really dug a lot of that Ferrari movie, I cannot get rid of the image of poor Marino Franchitti being hurled 80,000 feet into the air.
It's true. That is a little on the nose. But throughout this, because they've chosen such a specific story, and because they... I don't want to say that it's kind of written by numbers, because I think that is unfair. You have this narrator, you have this person that you're following throughout the film who is charismatic, he is driven, he's very Italian, But then he has these kind of moments where you could almost draw a line of the film and go, he's going to do this. He's going to... I don't want to say, because I don't know which bits are real and which bits aren't, but, you know, he has a run-in with race officials where he is kind of a bit smarmy and gets away with it. And then it's kind of like, rally, 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 rally. And now this other bit of plot happens. And rally, rally, rally. And now this happens. And you can almost... You almost feel like the film could be a lot shorter because there's nothing really that's a high or a low. There's bits of jeopardy that build up, and it's an interesting take. And I think if you'd done it from the Audi side, possibly it would have been a more boring film. But it was one of those things that just... It felt like a wonderful film, brilliantly made. I think the efforts they went to in the production were extraordinary. If you like that era, go and watch it. But it kind of reminds me of the Steve McQueen film Le Mans, which is a really weird comparison, which is a film that I felt really didn't have that much of a story. You're following the events on track. And with this, if you kind of edited out a lot of the behind-the-scenes boardroom stuff that happens, and most of it, you could take all that out and it wouldn't change the film that much. And I think that's the thing that lets it down for me. I think it's an interesting watch. I think I will probably watch it again and I'll appreciate the craft of it. But did I love it? I just felt like... You know what it was, actually? You know the expression Chekhov's gun?
Yes.
There's a screenwriting concept which is... I'm guessing somebody called Chekhov came up with it, which is the idea that if somebody's holding a gun in Act 1, it has to fire in Act 3. So somebody does a thing in Act 1, and there is a payoff later in the film.
See Top Gun Maverick with the F-14 that's mentioned very carefully at the start.
Exactly, exactly.
I saw that in the cinema and thought, well, there's Chekhov's F-14. That's definitely coming back. But anyway, yes,
and there's a few cases in this film where that happens, where somebody says, oh, I don't like the look of this, and then later on in the film, it happens. And you're just like, it could have been so good. It could have been a better film if they'd maybe just found a different angle, if they found a different combination of where that tension in the relationship came from. So I would say it's a good film. It's not a great film. If you like your rallying, if you like pretty pictures of cars, if you like a film that isn't too challenging, go and check it out. It's on Amazon Prime and Apple TV, and I'm sure it'll be on Netflix very soon. Not a lot of money to rent. Nice way to pass a couple of hours. What do you think, Marty?
I'm largely in agreement. I'll tell you why I think this fails. So it feels like the people making this have never seen a sports movie.
Mm.
Because the way this works is it's an underdog story. And that's been done so many times. People understand the beats. They understand the structure of it. And they're expecting to get that sort of structure. And for all that, the actual real life story doesn't work that way. If, like you say, if you're going to rework it for dramatic and narrative tension or improvement, or whatever you're going to call it, why not map it onto a proper underdog story? And give it that structure and that flow. This feels to me like a passion project. So the actor who plays Cesare Fiorio is Riccardo Scamacchio, who most people recognize as the Italian crime lord in John Wick Chapter 2, who, spoiler alert, gets shot at the end and is the reason why John Wick gets excommunicated from the Continental.
I was going to say, hang on, I don't remember that bit of the film. Was that a post-credit sequence where, like,
no,
one of the Audi board come over?
He's it's that guy. You'll go, oh, I recognise him from somewhere. Where? I've told you, John Wick Chapter 2, which is a great movie, and if you are torn between the two of them, I would watch him in John Wick Chapter 2 because it's awesome. And he also... co-produced and co-wrote the movie. And so he's clearly in love with Furio and clearly very passionate about telling the story. And so he's effective. I think Volker Brüsch, I'm going to ruin all these names, as Walter Rohl is really good because he's basically like a retired rock star. He feels very much like he's just too cool for school. Although that said, him being a portrayed as a retired driver turned beekeeper, I did not know that Walter Rohl kept bees. No. But I had just watched, or rather more recently I have watched, the Jason Statham soon-to-be action classic The Beekeeper, where Jason Statham is a former CIA agent, hitman, super badass Jason Statham type who also keeps bees. I cannot recommend The Beekeeper enough. It is the most ridiculous action movie that you will ever see. And but anyway, I've got distracted. I really enjoyed this portrayal of Walter Rohl, but I don't think it's particularly accurate.
No.
And all the way through all of this, all I could think was Jeremy and the Grand Tour did this way more justice in less time and with possibly a smaller budget, I don't know, with more accuracy. And I felt like I understood the story better from what they've told. This didn't gain anything for me for being turned into a film. And I don't know whether or not they saw that Grand Tour thing and went, what a great story. We should dramatize this. Maybe. But it felt like a waste of a lot of time. Don't get me wrong. It looks incredible for the budget they had. They've tried to do the very best job they can with the production design. I think the sound design is fantastic. I think the acting is as good as you can expect. Daniel Brühl is a teeny bit wasted. Roland Gumpert is barely in it, really. He kind of shows up for a little while and then he's gone. And Daniel Brühl is a fantastic actor, not just in Rush, but see him in lots of other things. And it feels like a bit of a waste. He feels like he's sort of doing it as a favour, or he's slumming it, or, you know, it's a bit of a loss, really.
There's a lot of looking across the paddock at each other and a lot of kind of almost nods. That's about as far as a lot of the acting goes with those two.
Yeah. So this is a curio. I think this is for the deep rally nerd.
Yes.
If you're a casual rally fan, I think you can give this a miss. If you're a deep rally nerd, this is worth watching. If you enjoy seeing, you know, early 80s rally cars, and who doesn't? You know, one of the best photographs I ever took was of a Lancero 37.
Yes.
You know, it's a spectacular looking thing. It's kind of worth it for that if you're into this kind of era of rallying. If you are a little later, if you're a Group B person, you know, to the latter years of Group B, where we're talking about the Integrales and the S1 Quattros, or if you are of an age where Group A and then the WRC cars, your sort of McRae's and your Macanans, give this a miss. Like, you've probably seen the Grand Tour thing. Give this a miss. Go and watch something different. But if you are that kind of deep rally nerd who maybe is wearing a bubble hat right now and understands what we mean when we say Kiel de Forest, give it a look, but go in with your eyes open, I would say. So that is Race for Glory : Audi versus Lancia.
Shall we go on to now a movie about a different rally that was much more recent?
Yes. So I was sent this by, I forget, I think it was Chris Frew again, sent me this, friend of the show, friend of mine who knows the kind of thing I'm going to dig. And he sent me this film about the Rally with No Name. It's the 2023 edition. The Rally with No Name is a rally put together by Tuttle Porsche. It's held out somewhere in Sweden?
Somewhere frozen.
If you follow YouTube and if you follow Chris Harris in particular, you'll have probably seen his short video on competing in the Rally with No Name. And this is a more lengthy cut. I don't think it's made. I'm not sure if it's made by the same people. This feels to me like an internal film. So it covers the whole rally. It's set over 3 days. There's a number of stages, some of which are WRC level stages. Everyone is driving a Tuttle prepared classic Porsche rally car. I'm not sure if they're all exactly the same. I'm not sure if they're all owned by the clients or if they're owned by Tuttle Hills. I'm not 100% clear on that.
They're not all the same because Chris is driving a 2-litre short wheelbase, whereas some of the other people are driving, I think, 2.7s. So, yes, there are a collection of different historic Tuttle Porsches, including one brief interlude where Richard Tuttle gets into a 997 RGT car that they competed in the WRC with and went, yeah, Porsche only homologated one of these in 1973 and they just happened to put a sequential gearbox in it.
It's a funny little moment. This is a fantastic movie. This feels like it's made for your mate, their mates. It feels like it's made for them. It feels like it's full of inside jokes.
It's beautiful.
So I sent a text to Chris. It's really well shot. It plays fast and loose with the concepts of music copyright in particular.
Yes, so go and watch this before it gets removed, please.
I sent this to Chris saying, watch this before YouTube take it down for copyright strikes, because it opens, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, it opens with the music from the opening of Top Gun. Harold Faltermeyer's very, very evocative music. But instead of it being carrier, you know, an aircraft carrier with all sorts of on-deck shenanigans, it's very contrasty scenes of classic Porsches being shunted around in slow motion in the garage, and it works brilliantly. Really, it's very funny. It's really well done. It's a fascinating insight into an event that I would love to have the money to do.
Oh, God, yes.
You know, it's a lot of money. There is a degree of rich people dicking about to it, but it's not offensive. You are vicariously enjoying it with them. You are along for the ride. They're not... This doesn't feel like, let's say, a later Gumball rally where it's all glitz and glamour and look at how rich I am and my supercars. There's none of that. And it's a joy to see classic Porsches being driven on the limit on snow and ice by a bunch of people who are clearly having the time of their lives. And it's a great soundtrack. It's very funny. It's very sweary. If you have small children or even medium-sized children, I would watch this when they are well out of earshot because it's very sweary. It is such a joy to watch all of these people having such a good time on an event that is very clearly curated for a certain type of person. Mm. Bobble hats very much required. No sign of Tony Mason. No one throwing snowballs at a very short man in a flat cap. More's the pity, quite frankly. The Rally with No Name 2024 needs to have more like cardboard standees of a small Tony Mason that when you're driving on the last stage, you have to reach out the window and throw a snowball at. And there is a really, really deep cut for people of a certain age who will remember Top Gear Rally Report. But yes, please, if you watch one rally film, then watch the Rally with No Name before it gets taken down by YouTube for copyright violations.
Definitely. And you're absolutely right. We always talk about the sort of videos where you get halfway through it and you're going, I wonder how much those are in the classifieds. I wonder if they, you know, what spec will I have mine in? This is...
I've got some thoughts on that later on in the episode, for sure.
But this is the event equivalent to that. You're like, that looks like a group of mates having the best time. And I wish my pockets were deep enough that I could go and have a great time with them as well. And
yeah, I've always wanted to do ice driving, and it's always been just that bit too much out of reach in terms of wanting to do it. Like, I don't want to go and do it. I know you could do it in an old ratty BMW 1 Series, but I kind of want something a bit sexier than that. I know that that's not the point, and it's, you know, it's rear wheel driving, you'd be sliding it anyway. But you know, Tuttle's make it seem so cool in Porsches that.
It's
a lot of money. Anyway, that's probably our rallying movie pick for now. Let's visit Henry Catchpole Corner and see what he's been up to since we've last recorded.
Well, I thought we could see what he's been up to since we last recorded, but I was reminded that the Subaru P25, the WRC car for the road, has now started reaching second-hand dealers for £100,000. And I went...
Is that all? I thought they were more than that. I thought like 250K.
They are, I think one's up for 650. I think one's near 800.
Okay, right.
Genuinely, they are astonishingly expensive, but they are actually quite cool. And then, so that led me to Henry's film on the ProDrive P25, which made me want to buy one. And then I also, it said, would you also like to watch a film about Henry driving the recreation of the O37? And I thought, I see a theme here. So this week, instead of some of his new content that we'll come to in future episodes, go and see if you want to buy either a Restomod O37 or a P25 by ProDrive, whatever it's called. Speaking of which, actually, quick tangent. Did you know that there's a court case between Singer and Porsche North America at the moment?
I did not know.
Again, this seems to have not been picked up by the news. If you go to Singer's website and you look at any of their car pages, at the bottom there is a very strongly worded disclaimer that says, Singer, do not sell Porsches, and we are not affiliated with Porsche, we have nothing to do with Porsche, and we don't sell 911s, we reimagine them. So any,
that's always been their thing. That's been their reimagined by Singer. It's a 911 reimagined by Singer. It's always been the badge on the back.
It has, but that's because they can't call it a Singer 911. They can't call it a Singer Porsche 911. There is some legalese there that is very, very deliberate. And there's now, if I remember rightly, I think it's currently sealed, but there is a lawsuit from Porsche North America to Singer. It has been suggested that it might be in order to, in order to protect their copyright, Porsche have to defend the copyright. And even if Singer ends up settling with them for like $1 or something, if they don't do it with Singer, then they can't do it with all of the other companies that are coming along. Anyway, I digress. So the ProDrive P25, basically, if you've won the Euro Millions jackpot anytime soon and you're suddenly worth £100 million and you fancy a couple of Restomod rally cars, go watch these two videos. We'll catch up with Henry's content in the future. And now, you had an idea for our episode picks this week.
Well, this came up in the excellent Collecting Cars podcast, which was, what would be your desert island YouTube video? Like, you can have one YouTube video to watch when you're on your desert island video. What would you choose? And through, you know, lots of people came with lots of suggestions, people picking some Chris Harris videos or whatever. But I think it was Harris who actually chose a really great shout, which is the Colin McRae on board from the 2001 Wales Rally GB. You'll all know the one. You'll all have watched it. You'll all have marvelled at it. And it's as good a shout as I can think of. I'm not even going to... We won't link it in the show notes. Just go, if you haven't seen this piece of footage, go and watch it right now. It's like 9 minutes long. There's two versions. There's like the version that's been up online for ages. And then I didn't realise, but Chris had said that Nicky Grist has recorded his own version with some commentary over the top,
sort of
basically explaining what their thought process was, kind of a very layman's breakdown of the notes, and then pointing out some of the more hair-raising moments, including one of the moments that every time I watch this clip, and I have watched this clip an awful lot, there is a moment where McRae goes through like a left-right combo at maximum chat, and he has the car set up for it, seemingly like 100 meters before the actual corner. He's made it do the movements so that he can go through this left. It's effectively like a little step corner. It's a square left and a square right, but he has the car traveling so fast that he has to set up for this in a fraction of a second to get the car whizzing through. And I had never noticed that on the right hand side there's a gatepost that he must have missed by centimeters. Oof. That Nicky Grist points out, you know, watch this gatepost coming up here. But it is one part of the video, it's probably two-thirds of the way through, where I watch it and then I go, what? And I have to go back and watch it again, because this is everyone's talked about this clip, but this is a man so far on top of the car. You know, it's said that that car was 40 horsepower down on the competition.
Wow.
And it's a man who is bullying a car along a track. Like, if you know that whole thing, if you're a racing driver and you get into a really fast car, it's driving you for a while, and then you feel like you get to parity. Like, think of Lance Stroll. Lance Stroll is being driven around in his F1 Aston Martin. Colin McRae is so far ahead of this Focus. It's like he's playing with it, and he's bullying it and forcing it to do things that it shouldn't really be able to do. And he's not driving outside of his skill level, but he's having to take such liberties with it to keep it competitive that you're seeing a man driving a car as fast as that car will go. No one on the planet could have made that Focus go faster around that stage than Colin McRae. And it is such a demonstration of forceful driving, let's say. I can't remember where I've got that phrase from, but it is, he's forcing that car down the stage. And particularly the last third of it, where the car is basically flat chat in sixth gear for a lot of it, and the commitment goes up and the sidewaysness goes up. It's phenomenal.
And bear in mind as well, when you say it was 40 horsepower down, this isn't like F1 where it's 1,000 horsepower and you're 40 down. They were, what, 300, 350-ish?
Yeah, three-ish. Between that kind of, you're aiming for that kind of thing. And it was down on power.
10% but down compared to...
One of the things of that Focus was it was quite robust most of the time. It was why they won Safari Rally and so on. It was a rugged car. But yeah, he definitely didn't have the fastest car or the best handling car. And he was just trying to overcome the car's limitations with sheer Colin McRae determination and unwillingness to let that beat him. And it's such a great video. It's such a superb video. That was Chris Harris's Desert Island YouTube video. And I think it's worth mentioning because it ties in with the rally theme. It's superb. Mm. It made me want to go and watch loads more McRae rally on boards. I watched some Richard Burns rally on boards as well. You can find there's a stage he did in Finland, which is particularly spectacular. But like, people who know me well will know exactly what video I'm going to say if I had to take one video from YouTube to watch on a desert island here. And I can hear a certain group of people are going to be like, yeah, we know exactly which one you're going to say. And I'm going to say it. And it's, with apologies to Henry again, it's Henry Catchpole's Aston Martin Vantage N430 on the old military road in Scotland. That would be my film. I could watch that forever and never get tired of the car, the visuals, Henry's storytelling. That would be my Desert Island YouTube video.
I have to say, I've probably given this more thought than so much of the stuff we've done, because there are so many videos that I kind of think of where... So the first thing that I thought of was Roof's fascination video, which I kind of discounted because, one, it's not a YouTube video. It's a video that is on YouTube, but it wasn't made for YouTube. And I think it's...
That's a good distinction, actually, because Harris's one doesn't fit that. Just a piece of random WRC onboard. But it's a really good distinction to say, actually, things that are made for YouTube as opposed to things that are made and posted... Things that are posted on YouTube.
But the thing is, it's that... It is something that I come back to. But it's almost like a palate cleanser. It's one of those things where I'm not invested in it. I just watch it for a bit and go, wow, and then I move on with my life. I actually made a list because I was trying to go through. There was most of the ones that I thought of were actually Chris Harris videos, to be honest. There was things like Kubica's lap of the Nordschleife during the Touristenwagen. Kenny Brack's wet drive in the GT40
that's a good one.
None of the wheels are ever pointing in the right direction.
That's another one. I'm trying to remember where I've picked up that phrase forceful driving. I can't remember where it's from. It's some classic kind of BBC commentator intro to a piece of onboard. But yes, the Kenny Brack thing, that's a phenomenal piece of footage.
And you look through, I mean, Chris Harris's stuff. I love racing, so he's done the Spa 24 multiple times, done Nürburgring 24 hours. The ones that kind of stuck with me, I watched the Mealy Miglia drive he did with Jaguar, where I think it was like 10 years ago, and you go, oh God, 10 years ago was a long time. But he's great. And it's one of those things where it captures the story of an event. It has those moments of the event which kind of give it a narrative and make it fun to rewatch. But The one that I kind of rediscovered. Oh, also, one of my favourite ever YouTube moments. I'm turning into such a Chris Harris fanboy here, but I don't care. The video he did with Autocar, which is, again, still on YouTube, with Mikko Hirvonen in the Focus Mark II WRC. And it's the one where it ends with him saying, when you go shopping, do you, like, drift your trolley through, like, set it up before the corner and then just, like, drift it through
everyone
the apex of the curve?
Everyone who's a car guy does that. Everyone does that. I was doing that around Costco last night.
But, no, the one that I found and I went, actually, you know what? This is everything that I love in a car YouTube video, was Chris Harris driving the ill-fated PF1 project at a freezing cold Silverstone. And this was when Paul Osborne of Cars International bought up an old Supra Curie, I think it was. And he basically had this idea of putting together kind of what TDF are doing now with the TDF1 program, where you take an F1 car and you run it for customers. And they had, I think, Mark Hines shaking it down, Chris Harris shitting himself, and Martin Brundle is this sort of careful old hand going like, oh, no, don't worry about that. You'll be fine. No, just do this.
I thought that was a Jaguar. Is it not there?
Well, so PF1, I think it might have been a Jaguar, because they also had some of the Supra Aguris, and when Pay Driver before Stroll, there was some. There's been a few drivers who, if they haven't had F1 Academy programs, Paul Osborne has run like Supra Aguris for them in the V10 era to give them testing mileage before they then went to a factory team. So I think you're right. I think it was a Jaguar. But yes, just Chris Harris being his charismatic Chris Harris self, but you can see this look of this person going, I've got myself into this situation and I'm absolutely thrilled and excited and I'm shitting myself at the same time, and there's Martin Brundle and he's just like a hero of mine, and now I've got to go and drive it and I really don't want to spin it, and I've spun it and
I remember that video. Is that your desert island?
That would be
pick,
my desert island pick, yes.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have come with that one. I deliberately tried to steer away from the Top Gears and the Chris Harris on Cars, because I don't think I can ever actually pick one.
Oh, it's
Chris
so
Harris
tricky.
On Cars video. I mean, mine was really obvious because I love the... I've banged on about it constantly forever and all my friends are sick of hearing me talk about it, but it's the visuals of it. It's the thing that made me want to go to Scotland and experience those roads. It's the fact that they had some sunshine. You know, it's a British racing green Aston Martin making dirty V8 noises and looking as pretty as old Aston Martin Vantages do. But there's lots and lots of other content out there. I could even go, if I'm going to be cheeky, I'd go the first series of Car Trek.
Yes.
Because it's still the best one.
Yeah.
It's because it's such a, it's an imitation of Top Gear, but it's done with the same attitude, and it's because it's slightly ramshackle and it feels more genuine for all of that. That would be fantastic. But it's a very, very tricky question to answer. but I felt it was worth posing.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily fully rally themed there, although I could pick any number of rally onboards, or, you know, there's a really famous clip. Not famous, but there's a really interesting collection of rallying clips that I often go back to, which is titled Thierry Neuville is Always Flat Out. If you just put that into the YouTube search bar, you will get a series of clips of Hyundai's resident insanity merchant Thierry Neuville driving the socks off of his i30N WRC car at unbelievable speeds, at unbelievable angles. He's a hero of mine. He's maybe not the most successful, the most polished of the WRC drivers, but pound for pound, he's got to be one of the most spectacular. There's a bit of McRae in him for sure, and maybe that's what I love.
Also, can we just mention, I know I've talked about Chris Harris, but the video he did, and I can never remember the name of it. It's not Didier Auriol, it's the other one. Chris Harris in the four...
François Delacour.
François Delacour. Was it in the 4 litre, or was it just in the 3.8 RS when that first came out?
One of them, yes. I know the one you mean, yes.
And it's a proper just turn up some bloke's house who then rags this thing and there's Chris
rags his car to
terrified.
Bits. That's, yeah, but it's Francois Delacour. That's what Francois Delacour does. In terms of other stuff, I know we've done loads of video picks, but I have been absolutely binging Larry Chen's Capturing Car Culture series from Haggerty on YouTube quite recently. I can't really figure out why. I think a couple of them popped up because I follow Haggerty and I started watching them and now I cannot stop. These are quite long. They're usually 15 minutes or more. They're quite in depth. He's done some really fascinating looks at how difficult it is to be a car person in places like Singapore, which have like unbelievably punitive taxes, and places like Indonesia where you can't import old cars. They're like providing they're younger than 2 years, you can import that, but you can't have anything older.
Wow.
So for example, in terms of R34 Skylines, there's five.
And that's all
in
there
the
will
country,
ever be.
And that's all there will ever be because no, jeez, at the time you could import them, no one was importing them and everything's like super expensive. And there's these wonderful series of videos he's done going around Japan looking at drift shops,
yes,
looking at tuner shops. They're so, like, what it makes me want to do is play so much Gran Turismo. And I haven't played Gran Turismo. I finished all the menus on the latest version of Gran Turismo. And people who have played Gran Turismo on the PS5 will know what I mean. You get to the end of the main menus and then you're like, I'm bored now. unless you are a very diehard gamer. But I do kind of want to go back now and go to, you know, circuit in Japan and race around there. Or more to the point, what I want is for Turn 10 Motorsport, the people who make the Forza Horizon and Forza Motorsport series, to make Forza Horizon 6 and set it in Japan, because that would make me very, very happy and put loads of tuner cars in and stuff.
But oh, yes.
Yes, Larry Chen stuff. There's a really good episode where he goes and visits a rally shop in Ireland, which has lots of old, like, Petter Solberg and Richard Burns Imprezas for sale,
yes,
and they just take them out onto the road, and then just the guys just driving it around, handbraking it into their car park and all sorts of stuff. That's really engaging. It's really, it is exactly what it's in the title. It's capturing car culture. It is so open-minded. It is so willing to celebrate the workmanship of these people, the enthusiasm of these people. There's no judgy stuff about taking a Ferrari F40 and cutting it up and putting a body kit on it. There's just the enjoyment of, oh my God, look at how cool this car looks. There's no judging about, you know, that's a bit stancy, that's got an enormous amount of negative camber so that you wouldn't be able to steer. There's just people looking at cars as almost like art. Engaging.
Larry has this skill, and I think it's because he is a working photographer. He has that sense of, what's the story? What have I got to capture? But I think, possibly unlike some YouTubers, he realizes that he is not the story. He knows enough to guide the viewer, but it's like, I'm at this place talking to this person about this car. It's not the I'm that's important. It's the look at this cool stuff. Look at their cool stuff. Show me the other cool stuff. Look, there's also another place around here that's got more cool stuff in it. And I love that it's cool stuff.
But let me tell you, this makes every single, and I'm sorry, tuner shops of the UK and associated British Isles, all of you suck. Like, all of you are shit. Go and watch these videos to see how a tuner shop should be set up to look cool. Like, if you go to a, you know, an independent Porsche dealership, it's all trying to be very low key and industrial and stuff. No, I need neons. I need Americana. I need, you know, just be children, because that's what these people are doing. They're indulging their fandom and they're letting it all be visible about how much they love all the things that they love, and they're not ashamed of it, and they're not trying to downplay any of it, and it is so glorious to see. So we've told you a lot of things to go and watch, but I'm fairly sure Chris has actually highlighted this series before in the show, but Larry Chen, Capturing Car Culture, put that into the YouTube and watch all of them on a 4K TV.
What I will say is there are two Larry Chen series. There is the Haggerty series, and there is also Larry Chen's own channel, which used to be,
It was Hoonigan.
It used to be the Hoonigan Autofocus channel, whatever it was called.
Yeah, the Haggerty capturing car culture is more recent. So you'll see them from like a year or so ago. And there's a lot of them because clearly they've done an awful lot of work in a number of trips over to the Far East.
Mm. I think actually... Sorry, that sounded very... I think you'll find, actually... Larry is doing content currently on both channels. So the latest episode that he did on his own channel was released yesterday about an 800 horsepower Safari spec 911 Turbo S. but it tends to break down very roughly that you're right. The Haggerty stuff is more, I went to a place and I saw this thing. Whereas his own stuff is a bit more eclectic. It's a bit more, there is a shop with a car and we'll have a bit of a look around the shop, but it's really about this car or it's an event or so on. But both of them are, I would say, the same level of production quality. They're the same enthusiasm. They're the same style. If you like one, go and find the other. If you haven't watched either, I would say start with Haggerty. And I'm sure the algorithm will flow you with, towards Larry's channel.
If not, I haven't seen much of his own stuff, so I'm going to go and seek that out. I will say to you that the moment I stopped watching some of these, that I mean, in quite a few of the ones in Japan, he's driving his own R34 Skyline in Bayside Blue. And I did go, I know these are really expensive now. I'm going to go on Piston Heads and have a look to see how much that... Oh, they're all over £100,000.
Oh, there's like 100 and... Well, no. So, right. If you want a stock, bone stock or stock-ish Skyline... R34s are about 150, 175. In America, they seem to be like 300 now that the 25-year rule has gone, which is why they're all being stockpiled in Japan. If you want to get, I think an R32 is maybe 70.
Yeah.
The R33 is like 45 because it looks like a rhinoceros.
Is my favorite one. In terms of looks, but if I wanted to have one, it would be the R34 because that's the Skyline that I grew up loving from Gran Turismo. And would it be Bayside Blue? Would it be Midnight Purple? I'm not sure.
So Litchfield can actually do Midnight Purple, and there are three different versions of Midnight Purple.
Yes, yes. I'd want something a little lighter, but it did make me go, oh, you know, if you had the money, would you want 150K on, let's say, a GT4 RS? Or would you want 150K on an R34 Skyline with a few slightly choice mods, 400-ish horsepower, not too rude and exhaust, really cool JDM wheels?
Let me ask you a different question. Would you rather have £150,000 for a pretty much bone stock, lightly breathed on, R34, or would you rather take that same money and get a new R35, a new GTR breathed on by somebody who knows what they're doing, and it's all modern and has CarPlay and a million horsepower?
No question it'd be R34.
Yeah.
No question, not even a single hesitation. What I would want to do is what another podcast favourite, Alex from Legit Streetcars has done, which is to buy a ragged R35 that's kind of broken and fix it up, because there is a series, again, another recommendation in an episode full of recommendations. But if you don't follow Legit Streetcars on YouTube, it's a fascinating channel, particularly if you like the idea of working on your own cars. And he's just picked up an auction R35 in a bit of a state, certainly a little bit modified, a little bit ratty, very cosmetically suspect, and is doing it up. That's the kind of R35 I could get on board with.
Actually,
paying 150K for one that's been Litchfielded, no, I'd far rather have an R34 and just play out my Gran Turismo fantasies. It's that test of, you watch a thing, in this case Larry Chen stuff, and go, oh, how much is a Skyline? And then you look at it and think, I'm sure these were cheaper. But then I went on and to go, I wonder how much an Impreza is, like an old Gen 1 Impreza. And you can't find them for anything. Like, I can remember a friend of mine and I shout out to Ben Bradley if he's listening. We nearly went in together to buy an old Impreza off of ex-Evo editor Nick Trott. He had an old, what was that? They, what do they call them? It wasn't the WRX then, it was something else. Something 2000. Night Industries 2000. I don't remember. No, I'm being silly. But yeah, he had an
That's
original
a very
shape
early one.
One,
yeah, yeah.
And we could have bought it for, I think, $2,000. Or maybe it was slightly less. We never got around to it in the end. I mean, I think we never got organized enough. But now you can't find one of those in the classifieds for that kind of sum. And if you want anything that has an MOT and no categorization from the insurance companies on it, you're looking at multiples of that. They're absolutely, even though even a ragged one is looking like $6,000 or $7,000, if not way more than that. I thought, oh, I could restore that in my garage. And and then just looked at it and went, no, Reality Bites, you can't get anything good for cheap now.
I nearly bought was it the P1? It was a bit out of my budget when I bought your M3. And I looked and the P1 Imprezas are now 30, 40, 50.
Yeah.
However, if you want to
buy... I told
you
about the one I was offered for $7,000. I went to go and buy a Mazda MX-5 in green. Mark 1 Mazda MX-5 from a farmer. And it was a great car to dick about in. It didn't have any power because it was 1.6. But he said, oh, do you want the hardtop with it? And I said, well, yeah, if you're going to chuck it in. He said, give me an extra £50, you can have the hardtop. And I thought, fantastic, because I live in Great Britain where it rains a lot. And he said, it's just down in the barn. And we drove down to get the hardtop for the car. And in the barn was an absolutely mint Impreza P1 in the blue. What's the Impreza blue?
Was it either World Rally Blue if it was a later one, or Deep Blue Mica was the classic?
It was World Rally Blue, then Deep Blue Mica is the darker one.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I'm selling this too, you can have it for $7,000. And I didn't have $7,000 at the time. I had the whatever it was, £1,600 I was buying this MX5 for. And it's not too soon after that, I went to the Nordschleife with a bunch of mates, and I knew a car dealer at the time that I was doing some work with. And he said, oh, you should have spoken to me. I've got this P1 in at the moment that no one's buying. You could have taken that instead of your Volvo. I'm selling this for $7,000. Do you know anyone that wants it? And again, I didn't have $7,000 at the time. But you think back and you think, how on earth did I not see? And this is where people who have lots of spare money win, or people who are more willing to take a risk, or people who are so passionate that they will get it done no matter what. Because I loved the P1, I thought it was a mega car, but I just couldn't see a route to owning one. And now I can't, because, you know, they're all mega money. But yes, I was twice offered what feels like an incredibly cheap bargain. P1, you know, inevitably, even if I'd got the money together, I probably got bored and sold it. I'm the person that sold it, the E46 M3, quite possibly the best M3 there's ever been, because I thought it was too heavy and I couldn't drive it properly. One of those things is true.
If it makes you feel any better, the best version of the car version of those stories that I've heard is Maximilian Cooper, the Gumball rally organizer, said one of his regrets was turning down the McLaren F1 that was offered to him for $300,000.
Ooh, yeah, that's pretty bad. I think that's multiples of bad, worse than mine. But anyway, we have digressed. We've gone over a little over budget on time. But just before we go, spot quiz, favorite rally car.
It's the Subaru Impreza WRC 97, which I think was the first one that they did.
It's the two door, the wide body.
It's the two door, the wide body. It's the first one with the Peter Stevens WRC kit, where they had to do 50 instead of like 500. And it was before they went for the multi upright rear wing, and
before they went to the bug eye and then the blob eye headlights. Yeah, the classic shape Impreza.
Post Group A, before they went bug eye. Close second would probably be an Escort RS Cosworth, maybe in a Mobil 1 livery. It was like blue on the bottom, white on the top,
I know it was on
the front of the Bird's Eye, not Bird's Eye, the Ladybird Book of Rally Cars or whatever it was I had had at the time, and still have somewhere. I'll have to try and dig that out and share it on socials. What would be yours?
I think you're right for the first one. It is that two-door Peter Stevens Impreza. I almost went for the 95, like the 555 Bat Impreza, the Group A one. But I think the WRX one looked better, bigger wang on the back. I have a soft spot for the Tommy Mac, but he was always the enemy, much like Red Bull are now in F1. Tommy Mac was the guy that kept winning and taking championships away from my man McRae. But yes, that, and a close second would be the 1986 Audi Quattro.
I would also say the other one that does stick with me and that I do sometimes look for to see if anybody's selling one was when they came up with the front-wheel drive Formula 2 regulations, and Renault had the Mégane Formula 2 front-wheel drive 1600 rally car, and it looked stunning. And it was at that point when rallying was on TV, and you'd see it, and you'd be like, I wish I could buy a Mégane that looked like that.
Is that still the big-ass Mégane?
Oh, no. It was the first gen.
It's this swoopy one, so not the... I see your baby shaking that ass.
No. Not the R26R Mégane. No, this was
the best Mégane, as it's known.
No, in my head. It was the first Mégane. It was around the sort of Laguna time when it was that kind of narrow headlight.
Yeah, okay.
Slightly sort of Ford Puma-esque rear end.
I had one of those Lagunas. It was shit. And the suspension collapsed on it.
I think Jason Plato might agree.
Yes. Anyway, we really have digressed now. Thank you very much for listening if you've stayed with us this long. If you are rallyists, you feel free to take off your bobble hats at this point. Do go and watch at least one of the many, many things we've talked about in this episode. And we'll be back very soon with another installment of YouTube recommendations and film reviews. Until then, we'll see you soon.
Until next time, everyone.